Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today we'll be getting back to some regular order after our candidate series, and I'll be taking time to speak with Concord's Communications Director, Steve Wynn, and Executive Director, Bob Bixby, as well as Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget Chief of Staff and Director of Strategic Initiatives, Mike Murphy. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The so-called Cadillac tax on high-cost health insurance plans, originally built into the Affordable Care Act, could get postponed yet again. The House plans to vote this week on putting off implementing the tax until 2023. The tax is a 40% levy on high-cost health plans, and Congress has repeatedly punted on actually implementing the law, foregoing revenue that was designed to help pay for the ACA. A proposal to sync the federal fiscal year with the calendar year is dividing members of an advisory panel charged with recommending a revamped budget process. The hope is that the extra few months of work time would be enough to help lawmakers pass spending bills on time, with the threat of working through Christmas as an additional motivator. Some lawmakers are opposing the switch on the grounds that they do not believe the fiscal calendar is the reason for problems in the budget and appropriations process. The House this week is set to pass final versions of three spending bills out of 12 that could become law in time for the new fiscal year. House and Senate negotiators have put the finishing touches on a $147 billion spending package that contains the Energy Water, Military Construction VA, and Legislative Branch bills for the fiscal year 2019, which begins October 1st. The last time three regular spending bills were signed into law on time was a decade ago in 2008, and the last time all annual spending bills were passed was in 1996. But with only 7 days of session left this month, a continuing resolution will likely still be needed to avoid at least a partial government shutdown, since several of the appropriations bills aren't likely to be completed on time. This week, the idea of Tax Cuts 2.0 became more of a reality under a package of bills unveiled by the House Ways and Means Chairman. The effort lacks bipartisan support, and it's unclear whether the Senate will consider it. Cost estimates vary, but one of the primary focuses of the legislation is making individual tax cuts permanent, which could cost about $600 billion over 10 years. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Up next, I'll be joined on the program by Concord's Communications Director, Steve Wynn, to discuss an Urban Institute report on how little the federal government spends on children. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Steve Wynn. Steve is the Concord Coalition's Communications Director. He handles media requests and works with the organization's policy experts in preparing issue briefs, blogs, op-ed articles, and broadcast commentary, much like this one. He edits Concord's weekly newsletter. Steve even dabbles in grassroots outreach by speaking to college classes, community groups, and more. Before joining Concord, he actually worked for the Kansas City Star for about 30 years. Thanks for joining the show, Steve.
Glad to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you on Facing the Future, and I had you on today because there's a really important topic I wanted us to discuss and sort of dive into a little more. You recently wrote a piece on how much the federal government invests or how little the federal government invests in children. So I wondered if you could give us a quick summary of your research there and what the findings were.
Yeah, well, this is something that we talk about at Concord a lot, is that if you go out and talk to average Americans, they say their big priority is their kids and building a better future for their kids. But it's striking that that attitude is not reflected really in the federal budget, which is largely devoted to things other than children. I was writing a piece about that recently and went back and looked back at a report that the Urban Institute did this summer that put together some numbers about the issue, and I thought they were some numbers that sort of jumped out at me. For example, the children's share of the budget is projected to drop from 9.4% to 6.9% over the next decade. So it's, you know, about 9% of the total budget now, and it's heading downwards. Doesn't really seem to reflect a big commitment to our children and grandchildren and the next generation.
And Steve, that's a number that jumped out at me when I was reading your report or your summary of that report. Historically, have we always spent around 9 or 10% of the budget on children in some capacity? Is that a number that was already going down?
The Urban Institute does this report about once a year, and they're looking back over at least last 12 years, and I'm not exactly certain how that compares with the past. I know looking towards the future, it looks like the numbers are going to get worse and worse in terms of money spent on children's programs or programs that benefit children. It's just it's going to be squeezed by some other factors like the growth of entitlement spending and higher interest on the federal debt as the federal debt gets bigger.
And Steve, you also mentioned that 9% going down to, what was it, around 6% of the budget?
6.9% over the next decade.
Can you give sort of a dollar figure? Like, what's that look like in terms of billions of dollars, and which in and of itself is a huge number, but can you give us sort of an idea in monetary terms what that trend looks like and what we're going from and what we're heading toward?
Well, they said last year they calculated that it was $375 billion spent on children out of a total federal budget of $3.9 trillion. So not a big slice. There were some tax breaks that are associated with children, too, but again, those are just a fraction of the tax breaks that the government gives for other things.
What areas of spending qualify as investing in children? Are those dollar figures reflective of any tax credits that come along that are attributed to benefiting children, or are we talking about actual spending programs, and if so, what are they?
Well, there are some tax benefits for families with children, and there's also direct spending. The biggest piece of direct spending is Medicare, and they've noted that over the years that the trend seems to be towards more and more of the money that's spent on kids tends to be needed by or aimed for low-income children.
And you mentioned Medicare. I'm curious. Did you mean Medicaid when you said the largest program?
I'm sorry. Medicaid. Yeah. Okay. Medicaid.
Just wanted to make sure we were on the same page. So are there any?
Yeah.
Are there any more targeted programs? You mentioned how Medicaid really helps children in lower income families, but are there any specific sort of line item programs in the federal budget that are spent dedicated toward children, and are they at risk in, say, the appropriations process that we're currently going through?
You know, some of it would be for education. A lot of it is for health, obviously, with Medicaid. Some of it is just income security programs for poor families. You know, I don't know exactly where all that stands with the legislation they're working on now, but this report sort of looks at the big overall picture, and it certainly isn't helpful if you don't have enough money to, you know, provide kids with the medical care or other, you know, nutritional needs. If you don't have that, you know, it's going to make it that much more difficult for those kids to succeed in the future. And we're counting on the, you know, upcoming generations to be very productive, because there's going to be a lot of older Americans, and a lot of them are going to be out of the workforce or are leaving the workforce now. And so it's, you know, also in society's interest that we have kids who are well educated and can join the workforce and be productive.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Steve Wynn about a recent Urban Institute report on federal investment in children. And Steve, since you mentioned that the report focuses pretty heavily on sort of the big picture of how that spending has changed or how it's likely to change in the coming years, can you, I know we've alluded to it a little bit, you touched on demographics briefly and some of those larger spending programs, but does the Urban Institute specifically outline what is primarily pushing aside investment in children and what's taking over and why?
Well, it's not a huge mystery there because the entitlement programs are growing rapidly as part of the budget. That's something we talk about with, Concord all the time. And that's not necessarily that anybody's getting more than they used to. It's just a question of the aging of the population. As more and more people retire, the federal government has got to spend more and more money just to provide the same level of services for more people. And so you have Social Security and Medicare budgets going up rapidly. Another piece of that, of course, is healthcare costs rising, and that has a big impact on both Medicare and Medicaid. But that's where a lot of the money in projections for future budgets, that's where a lot of the money is going, is into increased spending on entitlement programs. There's also a lot of money that we're going to be paying as taxpayers, that we're going to be paying in interest on the federal debt, which is rising pretty rapidly at this point. So the interest costs on that debt are going to go up for a couple of reasons. One, just because we keep borrowing money, and we're talking about, maybe $1 trillion deficit next year. And then it's also expected that interest rates are going to go up, and so you put those two together, more debt, higher interest rates, and the projections indicate that we, over the next 10 years, we're going to be spending a lot more money on the interest on the debt. There's not a lot you can do about that. That really needs to be paid. So that, the entitlement programs, and some other spending in certain parts of the budget are more and more going to squeeze everything else, including, my guess would be, including programs for children, unless we make a conscious decision to do some things differently.
So, Steve, is it a fair assessment to say it's not necessarily a conscious decision to spend less on investing in children in terms of Congress, but more a factor of, say, maybe a lack of decision-making on some of those larger mandatory spending programs and perhaps some necessary reforms?
Yeah, I guess that's involves a little bit of mind reading as to what's motivating people, or what they say is motivating people. And I think that's something I mentioned in the blog, especially at election time, a lot of politicians talk about how important kids are. They talk about and highlight things that they're doing for kids. You see kids in a lot of advertisements, but I think you have to step back and look at the reality of the budget and those mandatory programs that you mentioned, and that I've talked a little bit about, Social Security, Medicare. Those are mandatories, not a great name for them because it sounds like there's no flexibility. Congress, mandatory just means that Congress doesn't need to go in and approve the funding for that every year. But there's nothing that's stopping them from going in. They don't have to spend that amount of money. There's nothing that's stopping them from going in and working on those programs, but there doesn't seem to be any interest in that. And it's something that President Trump, from his campaign, has said he wasn't going to get into Social Security and Medicare.
And unfortunately, Steve, we're running short on time. We've got about a minute left, so I wanted to wrap this up with sort of the action step question. Did the Urban Institute, or maybe even the Concord Coalition, put forward any ideas or suggestions on how we get back to a point of investing more in children?
Well, I think that this just supports the basic position that Concord has had, is that we need to have broad fiscal reforms so that we don't have more and more of the budget taken up by the entitlement programs and interest payments and not have anything to spend on anything else. And children's programs are one example, but there's a lot of other important national priorities that are likely to get squeezed too unless we sort of revamp the way we do things. And we need to revamp the entitlement programs anyway because they're not sustainable in their current form. So we're going to have to make some changes, and these statistics on kids is just being more evidence for why we need to do that.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Steve Wynn discuss a recent Urban Institute report on federal investment in children. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, Chief of Staff and Director of Strategic Initiatives, Mike Murphy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Mike Murphy. Bob is Concord's Executive Director and a regular contributor to Facing the Future. Mike is Chief of Staff and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He manages policy research and analysis on a variety of topics related to fiscal policy and the federal budget, as well as coordinates a wide array of projects related to advancing the committee's policy-related initiatives. Mike has worked for other nonpartisan grassroots organizations and on Capitol Hill, and has degrees from the State University of New York at Albany and the Maxwell School at Syracuse. Welcome to the show, Bob and Mike.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure having you both on the program, and I think I want to kick it off. I want to cover a lot of ground with you guys today, but I think we'll start with what's going on in the budget process or the appropriations process in Congress. We're coming near the end of the fiscal year, and the House has tried to be pretty active with some recent bills, and the Senate seems to be relatively bipartisan in their efforts, but maybe it'd be good to hear from the two of you who have your finger on the pulse of what's going on with Congress right now in the appropriations process.
Yeah, sure, Chase. So, you know, when it comes to the appropriations and the budget process here in Congress this year, the way I would frame it is a little bit of good news, bad news, perhaps. So, as you said, the Congress is coming to the end of its fiscal year at the end of this month. As they've come back from their August recess, one of the main tasks that they're trying to do is seeing if they can pass required appropriations bills to fund the government by the end of the fiscal year. Now, it'll come as no surprise to you and probably many of your listeners that the budget process as it's supposed to work hasn't been working very well for a long time. The budget process is set up where Congress is supposed to pass 12 separate appropriations bills that fund the various agencies at the federal level by the end of the fiscal year. But since the Budget Act has been set up, they have rarely been able to pass those appropriations bills on time. I believe that there's been only four times, I think, since the Budget Act in the 1970s, give or take, where they were able to pass in some form all the appropriations bills by the September 30th deadline. So the good news is that they've actually been proceeding a little quicker than in recent times in terms of getting some of these appropriations bills reported out of committee and trying to get them to the floor to pass them before September 30th. I think the House has basically passed about half, I believe, of the 12 appropriations bills out of the House. The Senate has passed out actually a little bit more than that. I think about nine of the separate appropriations bills, and they're trying to get to the point where they're going to reconcile and conference these and pass them by September 30th. It seems like they're getting close to passing what they call a sort of minibus of a few of these appropriations bills within the next couple of weeks, and it's looking likely they might pass a few of these by the September deadline, which would be, like I said, one of the first times we've done that recently. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that because of the budget deal that was passed earlier this year in Congress, which was deemed as a bipartisan accomplishment, whereby they basically increased discretionary budget caps by upwards of $160 billion over 2 years, let's just say it's probably a little bit easier for them to pass some of these bills in a more quicker way when they basically grease the wheels for this a little bit with some deficit financed spending that's going to really deteriorate our fiscal situation over the coming years. So I think it's a little bit here of good news, bad news when it comes to the budget process here over the next few weeks.
And Mike, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to ask if the previous budget deal basically greased the wheels for this appropriations process. So glad I was right on track there. What does this process look like if they only get part of the appropriations process completed by the end of the fiscal year, which is the end of September? Do we go into a CR? Are they going to work on a larger omnibus spending bill? And just for the sake of our listeners and covering all of our bases, can you break down maybe what each of those even is? What is a CR? What is an omnibus? And how likely is either going into October?
Sure. So I think, so what you mean by a CR is a continuing resolution. So what that means is that for those appropriations bills that are not funded by the time of the end of the fiscal year, when we'd be required, in order to avoid a government shutdown, they would pass a what they call a continuing resolution, which essentially funds the government and those agencies at a same level, very close to even level that's been previously funded for some period of time, while they give themselves some time to then hopefully work out those detailed appropriations bills. They are, I would say it's pretty likely at this point, what's likely to take place, since there's only a few weeks left, is that Congress will most likely come to agreement on some portion of the 12 separate appropriations bills that have to pass Congress by September 30th. And the rest that they haven't been able to get to, they will pass a continuing resolution for some period of time over the next couple of months past the November election, likely possibly into December sometime, where they will give themselves some time to then come up with another package of appropriations bills, potentially what you referred to, Chase, as an omnibus sort of appropriations bills, where they combine a bunch of these appropriations bills into one package and then try to pass them in the so-called lame duck session after the November election.
So, Bob, I have a question for you. I've heard, you know, rumor that there's some kind of joint committee out there working on potential solutions to what might be perceived as a broken budget process. But I don't know if it really seems all that broken. It just seems like we have a new normal in that we go from CR to CR or these minibus and omnibus spending packages. So I guess my question for you is why is it bad to have the process as it exists today? And is there even any hope to getting to some state of what would be considered regular order?
Well, the regular chaos is the new regular order. And that's why what Mike was saying, I agree with, which is that they're approaching some form of normality this year with getting appropriations, some of them, done by the end of the year, whereas it's been, you don't get anything done, and then you pass them all in one big, enormous bill after you fight over a couple of shutdowns. So while it may be in the abstract small steps forward, this year's budget process has actually been a lot better than in past years. The reason that ideally you want to do them one at a time is you can focus on them, and Congress can do its oversight, and there's a little bit of give and take between the two parties about what the right level might be, whereas if you wait for the end of the year, for one thing, the agencies have no idea how much money they have to spend, so it makes it impossible for them to plan some, and it affects good programs as well as bad programs. So that's is bad from that point of view. And there's no scrutiny. You just pass one big, humongous bill for over $1 trillion, and it's messy. You don't know what's going to get into it. It comes at the last minute. It's just a terrible way of doing business. So, you know, we have an improvement this year. As to whether it continues to improve in the future, you know, there's always hope. I think a lot of members have been thoroughly frustrated by how bad the system has been and have been making a concerted effort this year to get something done. And, so I think it might improve somewhat next year, but we'll have to see.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Bob Bixby and Mike Murphy about this year's budget process, and we're about to go into some other topics as well. But before we transition to something new, I had one more question. There's a couple terms that we haven't really mentioned or talked about recently, and that is the idea or concept of sequester, and then, of course, the debt limit, which I think was a part of one of our more recent budget deals where they simply suspended that debt limit. So where does sequester and where does the debt limit fit in or factor in to this process, if at all?
Well, right now, in terms of the budget process that Washington is dealing with right now, neither of those issues are really at the forefront. Okay, so we can take each of them in tandem. I mean, so the sequester, which the sequester was something that obviously got a lot of attention over the last few years because as part of Budget Control Act back in, I think, 2011, the Budget Control Act set up a whole process by which they set up a big joint select committee that was trying to achieve more comprehensive deficit reduction. And if that joint committee failed, which it did, they would set in motion what they called a sequester, which was going to be an automatic across-the-board deep cut in federal discretionary spending programs, which they did allow to go into effect. And that was in effect for several years. But what happened was that earlier this year, with the budget agreement, basically Congress has sort of reset the whole table on that, has now increased discretionary spending above what they had put out as caps within the Budget Control Act in 2011. So the sequester actually is, the sequester is a process where you can have automatic cuts. It existed for a few years, no longer does. And one of the things that we need to talk about is obviously how do we take a look at our discretionary spending levels again and bring them in line with a sustainable budget. On the debt limit issue, so the debt limit was suspended for a certain period of time as part of legislation recently, and that is not on the table right now in terms of trying to deal with that. That's been dealt with for several months. The thing that is being talked about in some cases is there has been some discussion a little bit about how to reform the debt limit. Right now, you know, the debt limit is a limit on the amount of debt, gross debt outstanding, or I'm sorry, public debt outstanding. And there have been some that have been trying to figure out if that's the right constraint for Congress to look at on a recurring basis. Some have proposed maybe replacing that kind of debt limit with some other recurring target of a public debt to GDP limit. So there are some conversations maybe about how do you reform that debt limit, but neither right now are big topics on the agenda.
And Mike, a little birdie told me that the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget is starting to take a closer look at sort of the impacts of polarization and gridlock in our political system, perhaps its impact on tackling the debt issue. Can you give us a quick summary of what you all are doing and maybe some of your early findings?
So look, I think that groups, organizations like ours and those that work with us, and obviously you all as well, that care about putting our country on a more fiscally sustainable course, have been working on these issues for some time. And I think that over the last few years, for sure, a lot of folks that have worked on this have been coming to kind of recognition that in many ways, I think the deficit and the debt have come to represent or symbolize kind of a brokenness with our political system, and that the political system just no longer seems capable of coming together to facilitate, you know, tough choices that need to be made. It's having a very hard time incentivizing Congress to come together and reach bipartisan compromise on issues that are required to do so, and in many ways actually incentivizes partisanship over making progress. And so we've been working with others to try and study and talk with groups that are studying kind of what has been driving polarization, what, if anything, can be done to address some of these root causes. And one of the things that we're doing now is we're doing just a lot of kind of events and different things around the country where we're going out and talking to people about the debt and deficit and talking to people about, what I've been calling sort of a second deficit that people aren't maybe talking about as much, which is a profound deficit of trust and faith in our political system. So we are talking to a lot of folks on this and continue to focus attention, hopefully, on this challenge of dealing with partisanship and polarization. You know, some of the findings of this, I guess, so to speak, as we've been talking with people, is that a lot of the drivers of our polarization and partisanship have been drivers that have been developing for a very long time. Anyone that's an observer of Washington knows that even though in the last year or two, it seems like the partisanship has ramped up in this town, it's been pretty partisan for several years now. And that has been driven by a lot of different factors over time, some of which are just trends in society that you really can't turn back on. You know, changes in sort of our media environment and how that incentivizes polarization. The emergence of social media and what that means in terms of the discourse from a political standpoint. But then there are other drivers, too, that folks will point to, such as the increasing of gerrymandering, the increasing role of money in politics, and what do those things mean in terms of contributing to our partisanship and polarization. So there's a lot there. In addition to the data, I think conversations about how to address partisanship and polarization are as important, if not more important these days, in terms of how policymaking is done in Washington. So we're continuing to engage in those efforts.
Yeah, it sounds like I sort of opened up Pandora's box there. We could probably spend an entire show talking about those issues, especially when you start getting into how we adapt to this new environment of social media and polarization and some of those driving factors. So I think we're going to have you back to talk about that, but we are running short on time for today, and so I want to get into sort of a quick lightning round of a few issues. And Bob, I wanted to kick it off with you. I know the Congressional Budget Office came out with their, I think it's their monthly budget review just recently, and I wanted to hear your take on it.
Well, I can report that with 11 of the 12 months gone in this fiscal year, the budget deficit so far is $895 billion. It's up a couple hundred billion from last year. The good news is that in the final month of the fiscal year, September, that is normally a surplus month just because of cash flows and filing deadlines. So the government usually has a surplus. So the budget deficit for this year is probably going to come in somewhere around $800 billion or whatever CBO was forecasting. The way we got there so far is that spending has been up by 7% overall, revenues only up by 1%, which is not terribly surprising since there was a big tax cut enacted.
And I think an interesting trifecta of numbers to think about is last year's year-end federal budget deficit was, what, $664 billion. We're looking at a little over $800 billion this year and maybe even $1 trillion next year.
Yes. Going up.
All right. Next topic. Going back to you, Mike, the House has put out, I think, what they have deemed tax reform or tax cuts 2.0. And I think CRFB put out an analysis on it. So I wonder if you give us a quick take on this proposed legislation and what impact it might have.
Sure. So very quickly, a little bit of history lesson, because I think it's relevant. Everyone will remember, obviously, the tax cuts that were passed back in December last year. And part of the way they had to structure those tax cuts is they had to do a lot of things to make sure that the tax cuts fit within a certain budget amount. They had to fit it within a $1.5 trillion cost due to the budget process at the time. And what they have just done yesterday is release another round of tax cuts that basically are going to extend a lot of the provisions within that first tax cut bill that they had to put in there to make it fit within that budget constraint of $1.5 trillion. They're now going to extend these out and to some significant cost without paying for them. What a surprise. We're estimating that due to the extending of some of those provisions in the tax cut bill, probably estimate that it would cost in this over $600 billion in the 10-year window. But that's because these extensions don't kick in for until after 2025, and that's just within this first 10-year window. But if you extend this out over the 20-year horizon, we estimate that these extensions and this second round of tax cuts could cost upwards of $4 trillion over 20 years, $5 trillion when you account for interest.
And Chase, I should just say that, you know, from the Concord Coalition's point of view, this is a very bad idea. We have a strong economy, which the administration is taking credit for and bragging about, and we have a burgeoning budget deficit. And those are exactly the two circumstances where you should not be cutting taxes. You should be looking at some way to start bringing the deficit under control. And just to mention the monthly budget review again, fastest growing spending category, interest on the debt. That's another reason why we should be trying to control the deficit and not run it up.
It's another instance of the words being taken right out of my mouth, Bob. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Mike Murphy discuss the budget process this year, political process reform, as well as perhaps another round of tax cuts and their impact on deficits as well. Thank you both for joining the show.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Chase.
We will be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Elected leaders and candidates should heed debt warnings delivered by experienced former policymakers. Ben Bernanke, Henry Paulson, and Timothy Geithner played central roles in dealing with the financial crisis 10 years ago that stunned the nation and threatened economic disaster. The three former policymakers recently discussed some of the lessons to be learned from that crisis and how the country could best protect itself from similar crises in the future. While it was a wide-ranging discussion, all three men warned that rising federal debt posed a particularly worrisome vulnerability to the country. This warning deserves close attention in Washington, where the Trump administration and lawmakers in both parties are ignoring or dismissing deficit concerns, even as the projected shortfalls worsen. Bernanke served as chairman of the Federal Reserve during the financial crisis. Paulson was Treasury Secretary in the George W. Bush administration, and Geithner held that job in the Obama administration. All three recently spoke to journalists at an event with the Brookings Institution. Paulson said this concerning the growing budget deficit. Quote, "If we don't act, that is the most certain fiscal or economic crisis we will have. It will slowly strangle us. It will squeeze out all sorts of things we need to do." End quote. Projections from the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, show that interest costs on the federal debt are going to double as a percentage of GDP over the next decade as more debt accumulates and interest rates rise to more traditional levels. This would crowd out other budget priorities, particularly as Washington struggles to provide services for an aging population and to deal with rising health care costs. In recessions, the government generally spends more to stimulate the economy and provide various forms of assistance to individuals, families, and communities that are hit hard, as Washington did during the Great Recession and its aftermath. An economic downturn reduces government tax revenue as businesses struggle and individuals lose jobs or take pay cuts. All this calls for additional government borrowing. But if federal deficits and debt are already high by historical terms, as they are today, such borrowing could potentially become quite difficult and expensive. Geithner emphasized this point, suggesting that the government now has less room to pump up economic demand than it did during the last crisis. In addition, he noted the Federal Reserve has less leeway than it did a decade ago if it needed to lower interest rates to help support an economic recovery. Bernanke lamented the consequences of rapidly rising deficits and criticized the latest deficit finance tax cuts and spending increases as poorly timed, coming at a time when the economy was at or near full employment. Geithner also had a timing concern. He said deficit worries prevented the government from doing more years ago to speed up the economic recovery after the Great Recession, and he thought large deficits are too readily accepted today. End quote. "I think the deficit fever of 09 through 13 was mistimed," he said. But he added, "I say the new complacency about the larger deficits is mistimed too." Paulson said that today's economic growth makes this the time to deal with the federal deficit and other persistent structural issues that are going to determine our long-term economic competitiveness. While federal deficits may be necessary to help pull the country out of recessions, it is irresponsible for the government to be running large deficits, let alone raising them, during strong economic times. Lawmakers and some candidates for Congress, too, have joined in what Geithner calls the new complacency about higher deficits. They would do better to heed the warnings that he, Paulson, and Bernanke have given and start using a strong economy to reduce deficits rather than increase them. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.